नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स। नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स। नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स। बुद्धं धम्मं संघं नमस्सामि। So our Wednesday evening sitting, an opportunity to come together and to reflect on Dharma for all of us practicing here. I think the theme that's coming up obviously for at this time is that aging, illness and death, and the theme comes up frequently in the monastery because people come and want to remember the death anniversaries of their loved ones. So the monastery we're often reminded of and reminded to reflect on the inevitability of death and of course aging and illness. But you know, it's with us every day in the reality of things anyway, isn't it? Our own bodies, for those of us, we're more mature, this group of people here, so we kind of a bit more in touch with the reality of aging, illness and inevitability of death. Also remembering my father's passing tonight, being his birthday today. And little Sumudu downstairs, the old cat who's going through her own stages of illness and probably getting very close to passing, we don't know, but certainly on its way. And in those moments when we really, you know, we can conceptualize this very easily as we do with everything. And I think I'd like to talk about that a bit more tonight, but you know, we can intellectually appreciate, yes, the reality of aging, illness and death. But not, you know, there's only really, when it really is right in front of us and hits us in the face, slaps us in the face with a loved one who's ill or dying or who's passed, or of a pet, a loved pet, or when disaster strikes suddenly, whether it's with our own family or people we know or even in the world at a distance, you know, it can also wake us up a little bit when death or calamity happens on a large scale. And at these times we can feel a bit shocked, but also feel the vulnerability of what it is to age, to experience illness, to be coming closer to the inevitability of death, whether it's watching a loved one or with ourselves. And this is something that the Buddha was constantly encouraging his disciples, people who he was teaching to help realize the Dhamma, is to come to terms with this, not just intellectually, but really look at the reality of it. It's everywhere, it's unavoidable. You know, but something in us, in our minds, really balks at the reality of it. And when we observe animals, I remember many years ago, as a young nun, I might have even been a laywoman when I first visited Bodhinyana Monastery, when I was trying to decide whether I should ordain or not the first time at Amaravati. So this would have been in 1987, probably. I was back in Australia thinking you know, having been in England and being tempted to ordain as a, I think I was approaching 25, but thought I'd best go back to Australia and feel things out with my folks and with Australia and see what was going on, if there was really something else I needed to do before that, and got into a bit of a dilemma. And so I went over to the Bodhinyana Monastery, which was fairly new then, fairly basic. Ajahn Jugguro and a young Ajahn Brahm were there. So I think I just stayed for 2 weeks. It's a whole other story. But what I remember in this moment is because observing a big grey kangaroo near the kuti where I was staying that had been injured. His leg had been broken. He'd obviously, or she, I can't remember, had been hit by a car, and it was laying near the kuti, dying, obviously, but slowly. But this animal didn't seem to be that disturbed by it. It obviously wasn't conceiving of itself as being ill, as approaching death, as, oh, my life's over, or whatever. It wasn't making... I've had such a bad life. I didn't make the most of it, or... But, you know, it's just... lying there, animals don't conceive necessarily, well, we presume, I presume, through observing, they don't conceive of an ego self. They're just accepting the nature of things, and, you know, looking at Sumadhu downstairs wobbling around, and she obviously looks very distressed or disturbed, but she's not making the big problem out of it, you know, she falls over here and there, and you know, we're addressing it, but she's... you know, it's not something that you see her. She's not perpetuating the idea that becomes stressful from moment to moment. So this is something we can observe with all creatures, you know, and it's very painful sometimes to see vulnerable creatures dying. But if you persist in your observing and looking at reality. You know, if we can't help, just to observe that there is a certain peace I've observed with creatures. There's a certain peace of acceptance. We can't even call it acceptance. It's just not conceiving of self. You know? And we might think that's a stupidity of the animal realm, but no, that's a natural intelligence flowing. You know, I think it reflects more on the natural stupidity of the human realm. When we conceive of a self, turn everything into a problem because of it, this delusion. Now this teaching goes very, very deep. It's not easy to get a handle on. You know, when we've learned, our whole culture is geared to educate us from the moment we've been born, that this body is you. Everything in our education system, our language, our people we grow up with, you know, we learn to identify with this body as being me and mine from the get-go. And not only the body, but the feelings that we have, the thoughts that we have, the memories that we have, all the different experiences we have, they're just assumed, taken in, consumed and assumed into that personality view that I am this, this is me, this is mine, this is what I am. So this is the whole construct the Buddha was actually challenging for people who wanted to awaken, to realize the truth that he had realized, the complete peace, the truth, the realization of Nibbana, the transcending of identification with the five khandhas, with form, the bodily form, feeling, perception, mental formation, sense consciousness. Now from the personality view, from that conditioned viewpoint, it's very hard to imagine what that would be like. And inevitably we try to imagine it because this is how we're conditioned, and particularly in our education system, to achieve something through imagining it, through, you know, thinking about it and then constructing ideas of how we can get it and achieving it in that way. You know, and the Buddha's teaching, it actually transcends that whole way of conceptualizing. Now we have to use concepts, he used teachings to point to things that can help wake us up to develop a way of, well, not even develop a way of seeing, but practice a way that allows the dropping of delusion so that clear seeing can come about. So, you know, so many of his teachings are pointing to the fact that, you know, these five khandhas are the focus of the grasping mind, the mind in delusion that attaches, that grasps, that identifies. The focus of that identification are the five khandhas, the bodily form, feeling, perceptions, mental formation, sense consciousness. Now, this is in an era 2,500 years ago, obviously in an Indic culture with a huge, a long history of Vedic spirituality, a rising Brahmanic culture. So his teachings are geared, obviously, to that culture. They come out of that cultural milieu. His teaching is directed to people influenced by that cultural milieu. 2,500 years ago, you know, there wasn't the scientific paradigms, the scientific languaging that we've been conditioned by, grown up with in the West, that have structured our way of seeing things, viewing things, and understanding things. So it's quite a different paradigm. You know, maybe if the Buddha was born in this day and age in the West, maybe his paradigm, the words he would use, might be completely different. Or they might actually be the same. He might still be pointing to this body-mind. He may choose different words. But it's fairly easy for us to see, even now with these translations, that, you know, we do relate to this body very strongly as me and mine. We do relate to our feelings very strongly as me and mine. And to our memories or perceptions or the way we perceive experience, and very much to our sense experience, what we taste, see, hear, smell, touch and think, conceive of. We very much, in our conditioned way of seeing and viewing, assume all of this to be me and mine. And so he may well use these very same terms and same paradigm to saying, look, this is actually the locus of where we need to direct our attention and to clarify our understanding. And this is the locus where we experience suffering as well, in this very body-mind. But he's saying it's also the place where that experience or construct of suffering can be let go. We can see through it, we can transcend it and experience something that is wholly free of suffering, wholly free of identification with these khandhas. And it's not that the khandhas disappear, but they're no longer identified with. So one's experience of life, embodied life, with a transcendent viewpoint becomes quite different. So this body and mind is no longer a cause for mental suffering. It still carries the causes of physical suffering. The Buddha got sick several times in his life and, you know, aged, lamented poetically about the ugliness of aging. And you know, and died with a dysentery or food poisoning in his 80s. So, but what we're led to believe, or not believe, but understand with the Arahant's freed mind, the mind that is no longer identified with bodily form, with feeling, with perception, conditioned feeling, conditioned perception, mental formations, sense consciousness, they experience that in some way, in a way that is just devoid of attachment. So the Buddha clearly stated there is still, the Arahant still feels pain and feels pleasure, but wholly detached. It's quite different. And I'm not reducing that to the animal realm, but I can almost get a sense of that with animals. You know, they're feeling pain and pleasure, but they're not creating an ego out of that that suffers because I'm in pain, I'm suffering. It's just the pain of what is. And if the pain arises and ceases, once it's ceased, in the next moment, it's like it's gone. They're not dragging the memory of that pain into the present, or, you know, creating a sense of self that is scared necessarily of the pain, you know. So it's just one kind of way we can get a sense of what that might be. But so this locus of the Buddha's encouraging us to really look at this experience, how we experience ourselves, and in meditation, the whole way of investigating in meditation is to inquire into this experience of these khandhas, the five khandhas. So this body and mind is something we can't, you know, it's with us, we're with it, if you like. The language is difficult. There is this experience of body-mind. And so every moment of our waking life, we have this opportunity to inquire into it, actually, to explore it, to really make clear this, what is this experience, then when we assume ownership, you know, assume this experience, this moment of sensation arising is me and mine. So in meditation we have that opportunity as we just sit quietly and allow the mind and the body to calm a little, to just be present with what's arising and ceasing in the present. We can see thoughts coming and going, different sensations arising and ceasing, different reactions to those sensations or thoughts, so different emotions come up, memories arise, they pass. You know, these five khandhas are observable in this moment, moment by moment. But what the Buddha is encouraging is us to really inquire into that, so we get clear what these things really are. We have a strong assumption, a strong identification. As soon as these things appear in our experience, a feeling of pleasure or a feeling of pain, whether it's a physical sensation or a mental experience or emotional experience, the habitual response is just assuming me and mine. It's so quick, you often don't see it. And then what we become more aware of is our the movement of, what shall we say, the kind of you know, that comes about through clinging, the not wanting. If it's painful, we don't want this. If it's pleasant, we want it. So this kind of shimmying around the actual experience, we're much more aware of that reactivity. But often not fully so. We're just engage in the strategy of how to get rid of this painful feeling that I don't want to be with, or, and even, you know, start conceiving of the future, how can I get away from this? Maybe if I do this and that and that. And, you know, so we're somewhat aware of it, but not in terms of Dhamma. In terms of Dhamma, we have to be aware of it as close to its arising, its manifestation as possible. So tracing it back to, hang on, what is this? What am I actually experiencing here? And tracing it back. If this is if I find myself thinking how to get away from something or just tension, sitting here with tension, feeling like I don't want to be here, I want to be somewhere else, for example, to be able to turn the mind, wake up to that experience, unpleasant, it's dukkha, you recognize, it's an unpleasant feeling, it's related to an unpleasant feeling in the body, you check out the thought construct, how the thought is kind of usually generating a sense of self in a particular situation that we judge, the perception judges as either good or bad. And we get caught up in that whole construct. It's a whole mental construct that we become, the mind is identified with, and just moving or shifting is uncomfortable with. But as soon as we start to investigate according to Dhamma and just come back to the most, pair it back to what is just arising in the present. Is it a bodily sensation, a feeling tone, pleasant or painful? Is it memory? Is it perceiving a particular experience in a particular way? Is it a thought construct, sense experience of, you know, painful noise, loud noise, or painful sensation in the body. Just start to look at the five khandhas just for what they are. Try to get a handle on what they are in our own experience. And then once you have a sense of that paradigm, beginning really also looking at the impermanence of these things. They're actually in a constant process of arising and ceasing. Awareness, where we can become conscious of the fact that these feelings, they come and go, sensations, they arise and cease, thoughts appear and disappear, sounds, smells, tastes, tactile sensations, they're all quite ephemeral. They touch us, an experience arises, but then if you stay with the actual arising of that, you see it passes away or it changes. And it's this seeing that's so important for clarifying the delusion. You can see the practice is not about trying to force ourselves to think differently or to believe in the impermanence of things or to believe that, you know, this attachment to the five khandhas is the problem, is the cause of my suffering. You know, not even to believe in that, but to take up the pointing to explore. But the exploration has to be in this moment, in the actuality of your experience, moment by moment. That's only where it's going to clear up the delusion. And what I mean by delusion is the assumption, this conditioned assumption that these things are a solid me and mine. Yeah? It's so easy to just believe that, so we actually have to challenge it. Not to disbelieve it, we can go the other way and say, not me, not mine, and dissociate. You know, we have this view, hold this belief system, no, these things aren't me and mine. That's not liberating either. So the Buddha's teachings are pointers or invitations to explore, to look, to investigate and see what you see. It's when you are really present with a sensation, whether it's pleasant or painful, and you see it arise and cease, it's very clarifying, because in a moment of seeing that, being so present with that, as with any of the other experience of the khandhas, with the cessation of that experience, with the passing out of something, There's a very clear recognition. It's not self, it's gone. In this moment, it's gone. And the only reason a sense of self arises is through that habitual identification and grasping. It's an assumption, you know, it sounds like there's someone there doing it, you know. I am here doing this grasping. It's not so much like that, it's just a habit, a mental habit of the mind that flows on, powered by ignorance. As long as the mind isn't seeing the truth of the way things are clearly, there's this habitual grasping identification that happens, and the resulting feeling is this sense of ownership or entrapment, you know, this sense of conditioned existence. We're entrapped in this body, assumption, I am in this body. There's one way of looking at that, or this body is mine. I may be separate from the body, but the body is mine. So challenge that. So meditation is the perfect opportunity to challenge that, to come out of the stories about self or the habitual ruminations, and just look at a breath sensation or, you know, a painful sensation in the knee, and just see what the mind does with that, to cultivate this quality of just present moment awareness that is willing, just that there is this willingness just to meet something directly or see something directly. So this quality of presence is really what we're cultivating, the ability to rest into presence. So the knowing nature of the mind is a naturally occurring experience. Yeah. And so a lot of the painful habituation of our mind is the compulsive thinking activity. And yet in meditation we can be aware of that compulsive thinking. There is that which is aware of that. There is that which can know that, that has some perspective on that. Yeah. So at times when we're fully involved in the thinking, and you know, we're really thinking, yeah, I am thinking and this is me and mine, and we're going along with the story, that feeling, then we have this feeling of travelling with it, and a feeling of no stillness. But if you're tuning your meditation just to resting into presence, then you'll start to see more clearly that these thought processes arise and cease. They continue as long as attention is diverted, sucked into them, and we experience this travelling with them. But as soon as we wake up to, oh, thinking, then that sense of travelling with a thought construct disappears. There's this arrival or awakening in the present. The thought construct ceases for a moment or maybe longer, and there is this presence still, which is that presence is obscured when attention gets fully sucked into these conceptual processes, or fully sucked into the assumption, the identification with any of these khandhas. But as soon as there's recognizing the experience for what it is, sensation, thought, feeling, memory, then that experience also is dispersed in that moment with the recognition. And there lays the presence. There's still the presence. And then one experiences a stillness with the cessation of that experience of moving with identification with the khandhas. So this is something that we practice in meditation, is to recognize this presence of mind. This is innate presence. There's different words you could use: innate awareness, inherent knowing, It's wakefulness, buddho, buddha, being awake, that which knows. It's just this, you know, when one rests one's activity completely, and we very rarely experience that, except maybe in deep, deep dreamless sleep. But if the mental, if the mind's activity, even for a moment, is rested completely, there is still this presence in complete stillness. So don't believe that from me, but explore, is that true? Is that true? So what is it, what is our practice, what is our way of learning to rest into that more and more, not through trying to get rid of all the stuff that's moving, all the stuff that the mind identifies and attaches to, but more and more waking up to it, seeing it according to Dhamma. So we learn the paradigm. It's easy enough to learn, you know, take these words like form, bodily form, feeling, perception, mental formation, sense consciousness, and take them in and explore what is that in my experience. You know, not just from the idea level, but in your meditation. What is bodily form in this moment, in this conscious experience? And if you close your eyes in meditation, you ask, what is this bodily form? All you have is a kind of a melee of a seething different sensations that are in constant kind of arising and ceasing. And if you stay with that exploration of what is this sensation or this form, you will find that it constantly changes. And that sometimes in meditation, and I'm sure you've all experienced, you might think your body is whole all the time, but in meditation a lot of those sensations drop away. Sometimes there's no sensations there, or just a very fine sensation indicating the breath. You know, and the mind, conceptually, we fill in the rest of the body, but actually in that moment of conscious awareness, the body is, we experience bodily form, is this mere sensation arising and ceasing in consciousness. So this is really worth exploring, because it helps to undercut this assumption of this body as being some kind of concrete form. You know, I am the same person, the same body I was from the moment I was born till the time I die. I am the same person. This person is this body with my name. Is it? You know, and we can break that down scientifically and say, oh no, every cell is dying and regenerating all the time. But actually, can we really appreciate that in our moment-to-moment experience? Because there is this assumption of me-ness. From the moment we can remember, notice we don't have many memories of the first couple of years, but as soon as our memories, you know, started to, or we started to be able to conceive a bit more, perhaps our memories start then. Is that me? This body, that assumes that the past is always existent. Yeah? But actually there is just this moment where everything is arising and ceasing, coming into being and dissolving. And this body is more about what you eat for breakfast and lunch each day than about your personhood, who we think we are as ego. It's more about just the body consumes the earth element, the water element. It relies on the fire element and the air element for its survival. Without eating, without drinking, without breathing, without enough heat, this body couldn't survive, couldn't sustain consciousness. So is this body really who and what I am, this sense of me, this sense of I? What is this sense of me, this sense of I? We can really challenge, have a good look at that too. You know, we carry around this assumption of me-ness, I-ness, kind of carry it around, but when we stop and look at it, say, where are you? Who are you? Show yourself. It's this very vague kind of feeling, tone, thought, idea. But in the moment, where are you? Are you in the sensations that, you know, are constantly moving, arising and ceasing? Are you in the sounds that you hear? Are you in the tastes? Are you in the thought? You see how flimsy those thoughts are and how many thousands of thoughts you can have in one meditation session? Are you in each of those thoughts? Is one of those thoughts you? Just ask yourself, where am I in meditation? Or who? Who are you? And see what comes up. Or rather, what doesn't come up. Nothing can show itself. It's quite it's interesting when you really try to look. Who is this me? And as long as we've got eyes open, we very kind of relate to this shape. You know, we've developed mirrors and we see others, and yes, that's definitely Marion, and that shapes Nathan, and that shapes Mel, and you know, this is, we very much use what we see, and our experience of the body that reinforces this sense of me-ness and I-ness in this body. But in meditation, when things really slow down, when the body disappears in meditation, even momentarily, you know, it's good to explore, who am I, or just who? Or the Korean Zen koan, what is this? You know, any challenging question that turns the aware mind to really look at this moment of reality. And what is there? What is there? Can you grasp? Can you actually get a hold of and keep any sensation? Can you get a hold of and keep any feeling or memory or thought? Sometimes we're very good at kind of kicking up the same thought again and again, usually the ones we don't want. Why is that? But can you actually get a hold of it, you know? I was listening to a talk recently, I think we might have all been here, was it Ajahn Amaro, who was recalling Ajahn Sumedho's technique, meditation technique, to someone who was had a tendency to worry. And Ajahn Sumedho, they were in retreat, and Ajahn Sumedho said to him, okay, well good, so use that as your meditation for this retreat, just worry as much as you can, whatever arises, just really worry about it, really do it. I thought it was a bit odd, but he did it anyway. Put energy into, you know, using this compulsive habit of his to really ramp it up and try and worry about everything that arose. And it actually really undercut the habit to the point that it disappeared. And he couldn't worry as much as he used to after that experience. So it's interesting approach to really, really look directly at something and challenge it with one way of looking or practicing or another. So speaking like this in terms of the inquiring into the three characteristics of existence, you know, the anicca, dukkha, anatta. This is the method that the Buddha taught so often in relation to this body, mind, the five khandhas, if we can see, basically he's saying that our delusion, what keeps us trapped in this conceptualizing of self, is we don't see, there's distorted perception, so we take that which is impermanent to be permanent. We assume concreteness, we assume solidity, we assume permanence where something is actually impermanent. It's an assumption, it's a conditioned assumption, because the wisdom mind hasn't seen the truth of it yet. You know, and the same with dukkha, it's like we assume things to be productive of pleasure when they're actually, they're not productive, they're not able to satisfy us based on the fact of their impermanence, changing, ephemerality, transience. So every time we try to grasp and sustain the hope of pleasure through something, it inevitably fails us, because it always changes sooner or later, if not pretty quickly. And the other aspect of the perversion of perception, as often sometimes called, or the distortion of perception, is seeing that which is insubstantial as substantial, seeing the self in something that is not really who and what we are, but we take it to be me. We kind of, the mind just assumes me-ness. So he's pointing out these characteristics for us to really investigate our experience, not to believe it, not to turn it into a doctrine, but to have a really straight look at your experience in the moment, not through the conceptualizing faculty, even though we have to use that to even make sense of the teaching, but to use this mind of awareness that can look directly at experience to understand what impermanence means, what transience, this anicca word, is pointing at. To look at what this dukkha word is pointing at, to look at what this anatta word is pointing at. So this process, this way of looking, way of investigating, is what gradually clears the mind of delusion, the accrued, the accumulated, habitual, conditioned delusion, which actually keeps us in encountering suffering in our lives. So when we get involved in meditation, you know, what becomes more and more apparent is how our world is constructed through our conceptual constructs, and by that I mean our world of experience, the world that we experience psychologically, is very much constructed through our concepts, our way of thinking, our way of seeing, the conditioned ways of thinking and seeing. And that's why it's so important to be able to see thought as a process, see it directly, how it arises, it comes out of this present moment, and our belief in those thoughts is something that we can witness, where this belief takes us. If I really believe in one thought or another, you know, it takes us one way. But if I challenge that, if I say, well, hang on, that's just a thought arising and ceasing, that's just a particular perception, you know, a particular view or a particular memory, or or a construct that's developed out of fear or hope, you know, hope for something to be a certain way or hoping something isn't going to be a certain way. What happens if I just don't believe that? Let it just dissolve, because it's just a thought, dissolves. What happens then? And when the mind empties of that thought, the mind empties of that view, that self-view, of that construct, of that perception, and one experiences something wholly different. And another thought might arise. You know, but we start to witness very clearly how these different thoughts, and these khandhas actually talk about them as five distinct things, but actually they're also... they all arise together. It's a bit like describing an apple. If you can imagine, I'm holding a Granny Smith apple in my hand. We can notice its roundness. We can notice its greenness. If I bite it, its crispness. You know, its hardness. And you know, maybe it's fragrance, you know. So there's five different aspects, which are quite distinct aspects of this thing called an apple. They're not completely separate from the apple, but they don't exist. So they're not. They're quite distinct, but they can't exist independently apart from that experience of the apple. So it's a bit like the five khandhas, in that they do arise together. So with a thought, there's also consciousness. You're conscious of that thought. There's the perception of that thought. There's the feeling tone that arises with that thought. You know, either pleasant or painful or neutral along that spectrum. And often the thoughts, you can notice the sensate component as well with particular thoughts, as in the form. So the form, feeling, perception, mental formation, sense consciousness exist together, but we can discern their different aspects. and one might be standing out more predominantly to us. Say if the feeling is very painful, then obviously, you know, that's what's standing out. But there's also still consciousness, perception, mental formation, and a sensate correlate within that experience. Or if one has transcended the physical level, then there's just the four mental khandhas that can be discerned. But there is that which can discern these different experiences. It's clearly pointed to in the Buddha's teachings. There, you can know, you can observe. He encourages us with enough stillness of mind to observe these khandhas arising and ceasing, to observe clearly their impermanence, to observe clearly their inability to satisfy. They can't satisfy by their very nature of their arising and ceasing. To see that they're not who and what you are. They are experiences, but in the very fact of their impermanence, how can they be who and what you are? They come, they go. So really working this investigation in the present moment, and so with that presence of mind, with that inquiry, in a couple of suttas the Buddha says, based upon that, seeing that impermanence and standing upon the deathless element, one can realize Nibbana. So this is what is this deathless element? There is that which is knowing, the arising and ceasing of the khandhas, clearly not identifying, not taking them to be who and what I am, yet standing upon, turning the mind to the deathless element based upon that insight that these are not who and what I am, or they don't constitute a concrete me-ness or I-ness, standing upon the deathless element, one can attain Nibbana. Nibbana simply means the ending of greed, hatred and delusion, the shattering of ignorance, the undermining of ignorance. So that deathless element, you get different people talking differently about this, but from the tradition I come from, and in my lineage of teachers, the deathless element is really that which doesn't change within our own experience. What is not changing, even as we're observing the changeability of these khandhas, the rising and ceasing of sensation, of feeling tone, of perception, memory, thoughts coming, going, sense consciousness, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, knowing through the senses. This we observe, is observable, is knowable in this place of presence, pure presence. So I equate this pure presence with the deathless element. Does this pure presence come and go in the same way that we see these khandhas arise and cease? That's an inquiry. So in glimpsing this deathless element, you know, the Sotapanna insight is described as the first glimpse of the deathless. Of Nibbana. So it establishes a confidence for that person in continuing the path, relying on that understanding. So in the Thai forest tradition, they point to this as the real refuge in Buddha, the real refuge of that innate presence, that innate knowing, is different to the consciousness khanda, the dualistic knowing that arises and ceases with sense experience. It's not wholly separate, but it's not. It's not the same. So in my own practices, it's been important for me to recognize this refuge within. Because if we don't have this refuge within, we can somehow be looking for the truth outside of ourselves, out there somewhere, or attempting to dismantle this experience of body-mind without a sense of refuge. So with Ajahn Sumedho's teachings and coming from Ajahn Chah, there was this strong emphasis on taking refuge in this awareness, in this knowing. So at first it might appear like it doesn't feel so still, it doesn't feel so clear, but the more you settle, trust yourself to settle into that in your meditative experience or in any waking experience, in fact, because awareness is the constant. It only needs to be recognized or remembered. So the more you recognize that and develop that as a refuge, one settles, there's a settling, a deepening. And things separate out, you know, become clearer. So the khandhas that you practice to see and to understand can separate out much more clearly in that meditative experience. So I hope these few words are helpful in some way. As many teachers often say, take what is helpful, leave the rest behind. So.